From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The joint opinion says the ability of women to participate equally in the economic and social life of the nation has been facilitated by their ability to control their reproductive lives. Do you agree with that statement, Judge Roberts? Well,
yes, Senator, as a general proposition, but I do feel compelled to point out that I should not, based on the precedent of prior nominees, agree or disagree with particular decisions.
Chief Justice nominee John Roberts refuses to say whether he would overturn Roe v. Wade. As his confirmation hearings enter their third day, we'll play excerpts of Roberts' testimony on abortion, voting rights, civil liberties, and education. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Judge John Roberts testified Tuesday he believes the Constitution protects the right to privacy, but he refused to say how he'd vote on abortion cases if confirmed to be Chief Justice of the United States. Roberts did say the 1973 Roe v. Wade case was, quote, settled as a precedent of the court. The Senate Judiciary Committee questioned Roberts all day Tuesday. Another round of questioning is scheduled for today. For the most part, Roberts refused to answer questions about any topic that may come before the court, but he did answer a question by Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont regarding presidential war powers.
Do you believe that the president has a commander-in-chief override to authorize or excuse the use of torture and interrogation of enemy prisoners, even though there may be domestic and international laws prohibiting these specific practices?
Senator, I believe that no one is above the law under our system, and that includes the president. The president is fully bound by the law, the Constitution, and statutes.
If confirmed, Roberts will be the youngest Chief Justice in over 200 years. We'll have more on the hearings in just a few minutes. In Iraq, a major suicide car bombing has killed at least 114 Shiite day laborers in Baghdad. 220 people were injured. It's believed to be the second deadliest bombing of the war. The explosion went off at 7 a.m. as the day laborers gathered in search of work. Meanwhile, another 17 Iraqis were killed after they were dragged from their homes in the middle of the night and shot dead. The executions occurred in the town of Taji. In northern Iraq, U.S. forces have widened their attacks on Sunni strongholds in the region. Over the weekend, U.S. and Iraqi forces carried out a major assault on the city of Tal Afar. On Tuesday, the U.S. attacked the city of Haditha. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, the Senate's most senior member, Robert Byrd, called for the Bush administration to withdraw from Iraq and bring the troops home. Byrd said, quote, "We cannot continue to commit billions in Iraq when our own people are so much in need, not only now in New Orleans, but all across America, for everything from education to health care to homeland security to securing our own borders." Here in this country, the slow death count continues in the Gulf Coast from Hurricane Katrina. It's now over 650 people, with 423 people dead in Louisiana. On Tuesday, President Bush vowed he takes personal responsibility for the mistakes made in the relief effort.
You know, Katrina exposed serious problems in our response capability at all levels of government. And to the extent that the federal government didn't fully do its job right, I take responsibility. I want to know what went right and what went wrong. I want to know how to better cooperate with state and local government. To be able to answer that very question that you asked, are we capable of dealing with a severe attack or another severe storm? And that's a very important question, and it's in our national interest that we find out exactly what went on and so that we can better respond.
Meanwhile, the Attorney General of Louisiana has pressed criminal charges against the owners of a nursing home where 34 people drowned. The state is accusing the owners of not following its own evacuation plans. In Houston, community media activists have begun broadcasting a low-power FM radio station from the parking lot of the Astrodome. The station, called CAMP, that's K-A-M-P, will serve the evacuees living inside, and the feed will be carried in other parts of the region where evacuees are staying. In legal news, a federal appeals court has ruled the government can indefinitely detain the Brooklyn-born Jose Padilla, who was accused of plotting to set off a dirty bomb inside the United States. but he is a U.S. citizen. He's been held for over 3 years in solitary confinement on a Navy brig. No charges have ever been filed against him. He's never appeared before a judge. The ruling overturns an earlier decision that, quote, indefinite detention without trial is unconstitutional. Up to 200 detainees at the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo Bay are taking part in a major hunger strike at the prison. The military has acknowledged 128 prisoners are involved, but attorneys put the total at 200, or nearly 40% of the total prison population. Since the hunger strike began in the first week of August, 18 hunger strikers have been hospitalized, including 13 who are being force-fed through intravenous tubes. Newly declassified sections of the 9/11 Commission's report reveals the Federal Aviation Administration was warned as early as 1998 that al-Qaeda could, quote, seek to hijack a commercial jet and slam it into a U.S. landmark. This is the earliest known warning that a 9/11-like attack could take place. It also raises new questions about the veracity of then-National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice's testimony before the commission. She told the commission, quote, I don't think anybody could have predicted they would try to use an airplane as a missile. This information was contained in the commission's original report but remained classified until this week. In addition, another declassified section shows officials realized months before the September 11th attacks that two of the three airports used by the hijackers had suffered repeated security lapses. In Texas, lawyers for death row prisoner Frances Newton are seeking a last-minute stay of her execution. She is scheduled to be killed later today. On Tuesday, Congressmember Sheila Jackson Lee held a press conference to urge Governor Rick Perry to stay the execution. On Monday, one of the state's main newspapers, the Austin American-Statesman, came out in support of a new trial for Newton. The paper's editors wrote, quote, the public cannot be certain of her guilt, but she's going to die for the crime anyway. Newton was denied a basic requirement for a fair trial, a competent lawyer, the paper said. Newton would be the 13th prisoner executed this year in Texas. She'll be the first African-American woman killed in Texas since Reconstruction. In other news from Texas, U.S. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay's top political fundraiser and the executive director of one of his Texas political action committees was charged Tuesday with two felony election charges of violating Texas election law and criminal conspiracy to violate law for their role in the 2002 legislative races. The International Labor Rights Fund has filed a class action on behalf of 15 foreign workers against Walmart. The lawsuit accuses the retail giant of ignoring sweatshop conditions at many of its supplier facilities overseas. The workers filing the suit are from Bangladesh, Swaziland, Indonesia, China, and Nicaragua. Here in New York, the Democratic Party held its mayoral primary Tuesday with 100% of the precincts reporting. Fernando Ferrer had won 39.95% of the vote, just shy of the 40% needed to avoid a runoff with the second-place finisher, Anthony Weiner. With more than 25,000 absentee ballots uncounted, Ferrer could still avoid a runoff. The Democratic nominee will then face Mayor Michael Bloomberg in November. In business news, two of the country's largest airlines, Delta and Northwest, are on the verge of filing for bankruptcy. And in the music world, a hip-hop song highly critical of President Bush's response to Hurricane Katrina has quickly become one of the most popular songs online. The Houston hip-hop group, the legendary KO, remixed Kanye West's single Gold Digger. Kanye's recent comment that George Bush doesn't care about black people and added new lyrics about Bush's handling of the crisis. Tens of thousands of copies of the song have been downloaded from the web over the past few days.
George Bush doesn't care about black people.
She killed me, mama.
I ain't saying he's a gold digger.
But he
ain't messing with no brokers.
She killed me, mama.
I ain't saying he a gold digger.
But
he ain't messing with no brokers. George Bush don't like black people. George Bush don't like black people.
That's an excerpt of the song, and those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Chief Justice nominee John Roberts declined to say Tuesday if he would reverse the longstanding decision legalizing abortion, but said he believed the Constitution accords Americans the right to privacy, which is the key underpinning of Roe v. Wade. Roberts' comments came on the second day of his confirmation hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee. While Roberts said the 1973 landmark ruling was, quote, settled as precedent, he declined to answer specific questions about abortion. During more than 10 hours of questioning, Roberts also refused to answer specific questions about voting rights, civil rights, and other issues, citing cases he could face on the high court. Tuesday's hearings provided senators their first chance to publicly confront Roberts since President Bush announced his nomination in July. Each committee member was allotted 30 minutes for questions. A second round of questioning is scheduled for today. Thursday, friends and experts are scheduled to testify about Roberts' character and qualifications. The Judiciary Committee is expected to vote by the end of next week, the full Senate scheduled to vote by the end of the month. If confirmed, Roberts would take over leadership of the court when its session begins October 3rd. Today, we spend the hour playing excerpts from Tuesday's hearing. A little later in the program, we'll take a look at John Roberts' comments on abortion with Kim Gandy, the president of National Organization for Women. But first, we begin with another contentious issue during the hearing, civil rights. In his opening statement, Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts talked about Hurricane Katrina and how it showed that poverty and racial injustice still permeate American society. He said the mission of the hearings was to find out how Roberts viewed the Constitution and its ability to eliminate inequality and protect the most vulnerable.
The stark and tragic images of human suffering in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina have reminded us yet again that civil rights and equal rights are still the great unfinished business of America. The suffering has been disproportionately borne by the weak, the poor, the elderly, and the infirm, and largely by African Americans, who were forced by poverty, illness, and unequal opportunity to stay behind and bear the brunt of the storm's winds and floods. I believe that kind of disparate impact is morally wrong in this, the richest country in the world. One question we must consider today is how we can take action to unify our nation, heal racial division, end poverty, and give real life meaning to the constitutional mandate that there be equal protection under law. I believe that the Constitution is not hostile to the idea that national problems can be solved at the national level through the cooperative efforts of the three co-equal branches of government, the Congress, the executive, and the courts. But not every president, not every legislator, and not every judge agrees that the federal government has the power to address and to try to remedy the twin national problems of poverty and access to equal opportunity. I'm not talking about a handout, but a hand up, to give all of our citizens a fair shot at the American dream. Judge Roberts, today we want to find out how you view the Constitution, our ability to protect the most vulnerable. Do you believe that Congress has the power to pass laws aimed at eliminating discrimination in our society, or do you believe that our hands are tied, that the elected representatives of the people of the United States are without the power to pass laws aimed at righting wrongs, ending injustice, eliminating the inequalities that we have just witnessed so dramatically and tragically in New Orleans? The American people want to know where you stand. We want to find out your view of the rule of law and the role of courts in our system. That's why it is so important, and I hope we will receive your frank and candid and complete responses to the questions we ask today.
That was Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts. Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin grilled Roberts about his views on the Voting Rights Act and asked him if he thought that the gains African Americans made under the act were beneficial to the country.
Up to Senator Kennedy's questions about the Voting Rights Act, and in particular about your opposition to amendments to the act in 1982 when you were an advisor to the Attorney General in the Reagan administration's Justice Department. In 1982, Congress voted overwhelmingly to amend Section 2 to reinstate the test for vote dilution that many lower courts had used prior to the City of Mobile case, one that looked, as we talked about earlier, at the effects of an electoral scheme on the ability of minorities to elect candidates of their choice rather than on the intent behind the scheme. While you were in the Reagan Justice Department, you seemed to have done almost everything in your power to thwart that congressional effort. Your view was that the intent test should stand, This was the policy position of the Justice Department, which you, as you've indicated, and you wholeheartedly supported at the time. Your memos make that very clear. In one memo, you lamented that the House bill then under consideration would make it much easier to attack, quote, such widely accepted practices as at-large voting, unquote. Now, those practices, of course, were among the most commonly used systems to prevent the election of any minorities to local government bodies. We know that the effects tests put into place in the 1982 amendments to the Voting Rights Act has been very successful in improving minority representation in Congress and at all levels of government. Do you believe today that those gains have been good for the country?
I think the gains under the Voting Rights Act have been very beneficial in promoting the right to vote, which is preservative of all other rights. The issue about how to extend the Voting Rights Act, again, my position was a member of the staff in the Justice Department. The administration position of extending the Voting Rights Act for the longest period in history, as is, without change, was in no sense reflective of any disagreement with the proposition that the Voting Rights Act was extremely valuable in securing not just the right to vote, but all other rights.
Well, what I'm trying to get at here, Judge, obviously, is this distinction between effects and intent. I mean, let's follow up on the fact that you said that these gains have been good for the country. Do you believe that these gains we've seen in minority representation would have occurred if your view supporting the intent approach had prevailed in 1982?
Well, I think some of them would have. I don't know if all of them would have. It's obviously impossible to tell, to go back and determine whether a particular application of a different approach would have had the same results or different results. I think that's very hard to
tell. Do you still believe that the intent test was the more appropriate standard by which to evaluate vote dilution claims?
Senator, my personal view of the Voting Rights Act was not something somebody was interested in. You have people who serve on your staff, and their job is to help you implement your views as a senator.
I'm not questioning what your view was then. I'm asking what you think now, having, and this is a pretty settled area, I think you'd agree, having seen all this, having been intimately involved in it, knowing it as well as you do, do you believe that the intent test was still the more appropriate standard by which to evaluate vote dilution claims?
Senator, I haven't studied the Voting Rights Act to determine whether the intent test or the effects test would have different results in different cases under Section 2. I'm in no position to make a judgment on that.
Be my sense that you would be a person who would, with your enormous abilities and background, to have some sense about that. I obviously understand that requiring a voter to prove any additional factor makes it harder for the voter to win the case, and that to prove the intent of an entire legislative body can be very difficult, especially when a voting system was put in place many years ago, requiring African Americans and Latino voters, many of whom have had limited financial resources, to find evidence of intent was adding an enormous hurdle for them to overcome. And the Mobile versus Bolden case itself, which was pursued after the Supreme Court's decision in 1980 and before Congress amended the law in 1982, makes it very clear, I think clear to all of us over the years, how difficult that standard was. African Americans from Mobile, Alabama had been unable to elect any candidates to the position of city commissioner for every election cycle for something like 7 decades. They challenged the method of electing city commissioners that allowed the same majority to choose all the commissioners all the time in at-large elections. And the evidence was very clear that as a practical matter, although African Americans could register and vote, they couldn't elect anyone. But to get relief under the Supreme Court standard, which you appear to have supported, they had to go to enormous effort and financial expense to prove discriminatory intent, including hiring a historian who could piece together the motivations of city officials who had designed the electoral system almost 100 years earlier. In this situation, the administration was not bound by a Supreme Court decision in deciding what position to take on the proposed Voting Rights Act amendment. So why at that point did you want to make Section 2 cases so difficult to prove?
Senator, you keep referring to what I supported and what I wanted to do. I was a 26-year-old staff lawyer. It was my first job as a lawyer after my clerkships. I was not shaping administration policy. The administration policy was shaped by the Attorney General on whose staff I served. It was the policy of President Reagan. It was to extend the Voting Rights Act without change for the longest period in history at that point. And it was my job to promote the Attorney General's view and the President's view on that issue. And that's what I was doing.
I recognize that. What I'm trying to figure out is, given the fact that you followed this issue for such a long time, I would think you would have a view at this point about whether you were right about, or the department, let's say, since you were working for them, whether the department was right on seeking the, to keep the intent test, or whether time has shown that, that the effects test is really the more appropriate test.
Well, Senator, I haven't followed the issue of the particular litigation. I had was involvement in some litigation when I was in the Solicitor General's office, in which we were effective in proving violations under the Voting Rights Act. Many of those cases arose under issues under Section 5, preclearance issues, and not under Section 2. I, as a judge, had a case, a three-judge district court case, again, arising under the preclearance provisions. But I'm certainly not an expert in the area and haven't followed and have no way of evaluating the relative effectiveness of the law as amended or the law as it was prior to 1982.
Well, with all respect, I realize I should move on to another topic, but it just seems, given how strongly you stated some of these memos, and I understand you were doing your job, I would think you'd have a view today whether or not those strong statements still make sense.
Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold, Democrat, questioning Judge John Roberts. When we come back, Roberts' views on abortion. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Stay with us. The Dirty Three here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 350 stations around the country on NPR and Pacifica radio stations, low power FM, public access TV, and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're podcasting at democracynow.org. And you can tune in tonight at 7 p.m. on our website, democracynow.org, and see or hear the Rumble in the Jungle here in New York. I'll be moderating a debate between Christopher Hitchens and British MP George Galloway. That's tonight, 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, on our website at democracynow.org. It'll take place at Brooke College in New York. Should be very interesting. As we continue with Tuesday's confirmation hearing for Chief Justice nominee John Roberts, reproductive rights were one of the central issues during the hearing. Roberts testified that Roe v. Wade, the 1973 landmark ruling legalizing abortion, is, quote, settled as a precedent of the court entitled to respect under principles of stare decisis, as that's Latin for to stand by a decision, and legally translates into the doctrine that says courts are bound by previous decisions or precedents, particularly when a case has been decided by a higher court. Roberts answered questions about abortion through the prism of legal precedent. He affirmed a right to privacy, the key underpinning of Roe v. Wade, but declined to answer specifically if he would reverse the ruling. The hearings also focused on the 92 Supreme Court ruling, Casey v. Planned Parenthood. In that case, the Supreme Court voted 5-4 to uphold the core holdings of Roe v. Wade and banned states from outlawing most abortions. The chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter, a Republican, opened the hearing. Specter's moderate Republican, who's pro-choice, he angered some within his party's leadership last November when he hinted he may block judges who would overturn Roe v. Wade, a move that almost cost him the chairmanship of the panel. This is Arlen Specter questioning Roberts at the hearing.
Do you think that the cases which have followed Roe fall into the category of a super stare decisis designation?
Well, it's a term that hasn't found its way into the Supreme Court opinions yet.
There's an opportunity for that.
I think one way to look at it is that the Casey decision itself, which applied the principles of stare decisis to Roe versus Wade, is itself a precedent of the court entitled to respect under principles of stare decisis. And that would be the body of law that any judge confronting an issue in this area would begin with, not simply the decision in Roe v. Wade, but its reaffirmation in the Casey decision. That is itself a precedent. It's a precedent on whether or not to revisit the Roe v. Wade precedent. And under principles of stare decisis, that would be where any judge considering an issue in this area would begin.
When you and I talked informally, I asked you if you had any thought as to how many opportunities there were in the intervening 32 years for Roe to be overruled. And you said you didn't really know, and you cited a number. And I said, would it surprise you to know that there have been 38 occasions where Roe has been taken up, not with a specific issue raised, but all with an opportunity for Roe to be overruled? One of them was Rust versus Sullivan, where you participated in the writing of the brief, and although the case did not squarely raise the overruling of Roe, it involved the issue of whether Planned Parenthood units funded with federal money could counsel on abortion. And in that brief, you again raised the question about Roe being wrongly decided. And then I pointed out to you that there had been some 38 cases where the court had taken up Roe. And I'm a very seldom user of charts, but on this one I prepared a chart because it speaks little too heavy to lift, but it speaks louder than just thank you, Senator Grassley. 38 cases where Roe has been taken up, and I don't want to coin any phrases on super precedents. We'll leave that to the Supreme Court. But would you think that Roe might be a super duper precedent in light of 38 occasions to overrule it?
Well, the interesting thing, of course, is the not simply the opportunity to address it, but when the court actually considers the question. And that, of course, is in the Casey decision, where it did apply the principles of stare decisis and specifically addressed it. And that, I think, is the decision that any judge in this area would begin with.
That was Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania questioning Judge Roberts. Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California, also grilled Roberts about his views on Roe v. Wade and a number of other women's issues. At one point, she directly asked Roberts if the right to privacy extends to making personal decisions around the beginning and end of life.
In response to the chairman's question this morning about the right to privacy, you answered that you believe that there is an implied right to privacy in the Constitution, that it's been there for some 80 years, and that a number of provisions in the Constitution support this right, and you enumerated them this morning. Do you then believe that this implied right of privacy applies to the beginning of life and the end of life?
Well, Senator, I don't necessarily regard it as an implied right. It is the part of the liberty that is protected under the Due Process Clause. That liberty
part
is
of liberty,
enumerated,
then.
Yes. The exact scope of it with respect to the beginning of life and the end of life, those are issues that are coming before the court in both respects. And I don't think I should go further to elaborate upon whether or not it applies in those particular situations. Obviously, it has been articulated by the court in both contexts, the Cruzan case with respect to the end of life, the Glucksberg case following Cruzan. But I don't think it's appropriate for me, given the fact that cases arise on both of those questions, to go further.
All right, let's move right along. This morning, There was a discussion about stare decisis, and you pointed out that there were factors in the consideration of stare decisis. And I think one of the things you said was workability of framework is one of the main principles you look for in stare decisis. Well, in its decision in Casey, the court specifically affirmed the doctrine of stare decisis as it applies to Roe. The court reviewed prudential and pragmatic considerations to gauge the respective costs of reaffirming and overruling a case, that case. In doing so, the court unambiguously concluded that Roe has in no sense proven unworkable. Do you agree with this conclusion?
Well, that determination in Casey becomes one of the precedents of the court, entitled to respect like any other precedent of the court under principles of stare decisis. I have tried to draw the line about not agreeing or disagreeing with particular rulings, but that is a precedent of the court. It is a precedent on precedent. In other words, it is examined Roe.
You agree that the court said that, obviously.
Well, it said that, and that is a precedent entitled to respect under principles of stare decisis, like any other precedent of the court. But in terms of a separate determination on my part whether this decision is correct or that decision is correct, my review of what other nominees have done is that that's where they draw the line, and that's where I've drawn the line.
So workability is clearly one thing. Is another one reliance?
Certainly, or as it's often expressed in the court's opinions, the settled expectations. People expect that the law is going to be what the court has told them the law is going to be. And that's an important consideration.
And in Casey, again, the court stated, and I quote, "The ability of women to participate equally in the economic and social life of the nation has been facilitated by their ability to control their reproductive lives, and that this ability to control their reproductive lives was enough of a reliance to sustain Roe." Correct?
That's what the court concluded. I think you're reading from the plurality of the joint opinion.
That's correct.
Casey. Yes.
That's correct. Now, unlike my experience, there are now entire generations of women who know a world only where their reproductive rights are protected. Do you agree with the court that this reliance is sufficient?
Well, again, I think that's asking me whether I think the decision was correct or not on that point. It certainly was the analysis of the joint opinion in the court, entitled to respect as precedent like any other decision of the court under principles of stare decisis. And that would certainly be where I would begin if any of these issues come before the court. If I were to be confirmed, I would begin with the precedent that the court has laid out in this area.
One other question on Casey, and I'd like to quote from something that Justice Ginsburg said in the transcript in her confirmation hearing in a discussion with then-Senator Brown. The Casey majority understood that marriage and family life is not always what we might wish them to be. There are women whose physical safety, even their lives, would be endangered if the law required them to notify their partner. And Casey, which in other respects has been greeted in some quarters with great distress, answered a significant question, one left open in Roe. Casey held a state could not require notification to the husband. Do you agree?
That is what Casey held, yes. And that's, as I said before, a precedent of the court, like any other precedent of the court, entitled to respect under principles of stare decisis.
Thank you. One other reading from Justice Ginsburg's testimony. Abortion prohibition by the state, however, controls women and denies them full autonomy and full equality with men. That was the idea I tried to express in the lecture to which you referred. The two strands, equality and autonomy, both figure in the full portrayal. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, I think then Judge Ginsburg felt at greater liberty to discuss that precisely for the reason you noted, that she'd given a lecture on the subject. Those are issues that come up again and again before the court, and consistent with what I understand the approach to have been of other nominees, I don't think I should express a view on that.
That is Judge John Roberts being questioned by Democrat of California Senator Dianne Feinstein. As we're joined in the studio right now in Washington, D.C. by Kim Gandy. She is the head of the National Organization for Women. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Your response to this discussion?
Well, I think that many of the reports of what has come out of this discussion have been quite misleading. And I think that's because John Roberts' answers have been misleading, combined with inadequate questions or inadequate follow-up. And let me offer several explanations for that. One is that he repeatedly says, and the media repeatedly repeats, that he says, well, that is settled law. It's entitled to respect as a precedent, as any other precedent under the principles of stare decisis. That is a meaningless statement. Of course, every precedent, however ridiculous, is entitled to respect, which means to be means recognition in a legal sense, not respect as in the way that you think it was rightly decided. For instance, you might have respect for an office someone holds, like President of the United States, but not necessarily have a personal respect for the person who holds the office. And that's true of this kind of precedent. What he said repeatedly was that he was not willing to state his position beyond what his writings were on Roe v. Wade. But he did give, in my opinion, and in the opinion of a number of people, he did give a roadmap for overruling Roe. He basically laid out several ways that a Roberts court, unlike the Rehnquist court, could and I think would overrule Roe. One of them is addressing privacy. Several senators said, oh, well, he says that he believes there's a right to privacy in the Constitution. And indeed, he said there's a right to privacy in the First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendments. But there are lots of different kinds of rights to privacy. Specifically in the Griswold case, which was the 1965 case that said married women could not be legally banned from access to birth control. He came right out and said, oh, you know, Griswold, I feel comfortable commenting on Griswold. That's, you know, that's not going to ever come back before us. That was rightly decided, he said. Under the right of marital privacy, and he used the term twice, he referred to marital privacy and the right of married women to obtain birth control. But the right of marital privacy is not what Roe was based on, nor is it what Eisenstadt v. Baird was based on, the right of single women to obtain contraception. And he actually said that himself in an exchange with Feinstein about the Griswold case. So he said, absolutely, I agree there's a right to marital privacy, and I agree with Griswold. What he would not say was that he agreed with the privacy basis in the 14th Amendment, as he called it, the liberty interest of the 14th Amendment. He would not agree that that was a right to privacy that he recognized. The rights to privacy span the First, Fourth, Fifth, Ninth, 13th, 14th, goes across many amendments to the Constitution. But the ones he recognized were in the First, Fourth, and Fifth, and marital privacy. For instance, unreasonable search and seizure. So the fact that he says that there is a right to privacy, maybe two or three kinds of right to privacy in the Constitution, does not translate, and I wish the media would stop reporting that it translates as his acceptance of the underpinnings of Roe. Indeed, privacy was the primary underpinning of Roe, but it was not the right to privacy that he repeatedly says he supports and endorses.
Kim Gandy, you're in Washington, president of the National Organization for Women. You are in the hearing room. What is it like there?
Yes. Well, it's most of the people who are were there watching, myself included, did most of our watching on the C-SPAN screens because it was very difficult to see what was going on in the front of the room with all the people bobbing up and down in front of you, mostly the press, which was between us and the senator. So it was difficult to see and hear, but there was a tremendous amount of consternation among the women's rights leaders, especially when we saw an early story come out of AP essentially saying that Roberts had said that, you know, that he respected Roe v. Wade and the right to privacy, which is the underpinning of Roe, essentially giving people the idea that he had endorsed Roe or had done so in so many words. There's a I just want to read you something from one of the right-wing groups that has been writing on this to their own people. It's called confirmthem.com. You're probably familiar with it, and it's sort of an analysis from the right wing about the hearings and how they're going. Roberts' answer was brilliant. He made a statement that will satisfy most Americans about privacy while leaving himself enough wiggle room to move the court on that issue in the future. And then just a few minutes later, they posted, quote, a top-flight leading conservative pro-life lawyer with a vibrant Supreme Court practice whose name most readers of this forum would know just walked into the room where I'm sitting. He was thrilled about Roberts' answers during the dialogue with Specter and indicated his strong approval and endorsement. He explained that Roberts' answer was carefully framed to provide a basis for revisiting and overturning Roe in the future. And that is exactly on point. In fact, he went through the bases for overturning. He outlined them as erosion, workability, and reliance. Those are the three standard tests. But he also added a fourth one, extensive disagreement. He was talking about Payne versus Tennessee and said that extensive disagreement is also grounds for reversal of a precedent, and essentially said that was the grounds for the reversal of in Payne versus Tennessee of prior precedents. He then went on to talk about the other standards, erosion, workability, and reliance, particularly workability. Hatch asked him, noting that in Casey, the Casey court abandoned the Roe framework, the Roe trimester framework, and in Casey also they dramatically changed the test from a heightened scrutiny of abortion restrictions to merely an undue burden test, which was a very, very reduced level of scrutiny. And so Hatch asked him, well, does that mean, since Casey abandoned the Roe framework, does that mean that Roe was not workable? And Roberts talked a little bit about the workability framework, but he didn't say one way or the other. In other words, setting up, Feinstein asked him the same question, he didn't respond to it. But then the erosion standard is the other one, because Casey did in fact erode Roe to a very significant degree, as have state and federal regulations since Casey eroded Roe.
Kim Gandy, if you could ask Judge Roberts a question, what would it be, if you were one of those senators up there?
Well, I guess my questions would have primarily been follow-up questions. I would have asked him how he defines extensive disagreement. Certainly you would say that in this country, although 65% of the public supports Roe, there has clearly been extensive disagreement about the issue. And I would ask him more questions about extensive disagreement and about erosion. But I think it's clear from what he said, I don't think he has been dishonest in the sense of what is. But he has been misleading. He has very brilliantly, I agree with the right-wing commentator, that he has brilliantly given answers that have led some people, including ones on the committee, to believe that he supports the right to privacy and the Roe framework, when in fact he has been laying out, and I hope never to need to say I told you so, because I hope he won't be confirmed. But if he is confirmed, I think that people will look back and they'll say, oh yeah, see here, right in the hearing, he talked about erosion, he talked about workability, he talked about extensive disagreement as being grounds for reversal. And gee, isn't it interesting? These are the exact grounds they used to reverse Roe.
Kim Gandy, I want to thank you for being with us, president of the National Organization for Women. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, a few more moments from the hearing, and then we'll speak with Houston Congressmember Sheila Jackson Lee about the scheduled execution today of Frances Newton in Texas. This is Democracy Now! Stay with us. The meters, the world is a bit under the weather here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Again, tune into our website at democracynow.org tonight at 7 o'clock. Live video audio stream of the grapple in the Big Apple, the debate between British MP George Galloway, who has come to our shores, and author, activist, Chris Hitchens. This is Democracy Now! As we continue with the hearing, Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin asked questions about a range of civil liberty issues. He asked if Judge Roberts thought the nation would regret any of the laws passed in the wake of September 11th.
Are there any elements of the government's response to September 11th that you think 50 or 60 years from now we as a nation will look back on with regret?
Well, I'm sure there are some, Senator, and when you have the benefit of 50 or 60 years to look back, as opposed to the particular demands of the moment and the perceived demands, I'm sure it's a different perspective. I'd hesitate to mention any in particular because so many of these issues are coming before not only the Supreme Court, but the court on which I now sit. And I will have to confront those cases, I think, regardless of what happens here. So I'd hesitate to identify particular areas of concern.
Well, I understand your caution. I don't think we need to wait 50 or 60 years for some. For example, do you have any concerns about the practice of extraordinary rendition, of our government secretly sending people to countries that we know use torture?
Well, again, Senator, that is something that could come before the court in one form or another. And I think I have to refrain from commenting on it.
How about the federal government using immigration laws to round up and detain people for months, often without regard for whether they had any connection to September 11th investigation, which actually, in this case, the Justice Department Inspector General later heavily criticized? Now, does that trouble you?
Well, yes, certainly. At a basic level of appreciating that this is a reaction in a particular way that raises serious questions. I'm very hesitant, though, again, to express a view on legality because those issues could come before the court. They are coming before the court, and they're coming not only before the Supreme Court, but the court on which I now sit.
Let's go to one that's already come before the court. The Hamdi case is one of the most significant recent decisions restraining executive branch power. In that case, eight members of the court found that the government had gone too far and claiming the right to detain and hold a U.S. citizen incommunicado within the United States without access to a lawyer and without charging with a crime. The case actually resulted in four different opinions with four different views on the president's power to detain a U.S. citizen indefinitely and without trial, ranging from Justices Souter and Ginsburg, who found that the president does not have any authority to detain citizens as enemy combatants because such detentions had not been congressionally authorized, to Justice Thomas, who would defer entirely to the executive branch. Which of the four opinions, in a case that's already been decided, in Hamdi, would you say best approximates your views on the executive powers to designate enemy combatants? The plurality opinion, the Souter-Ginsburg opinion, the Scalia-Stevens dissent, or the Thomas dissent?
Well, Senator, that does get into the area asking me to comment on which opinions I think are correct, that I don't feel it's appropriate for me to go.
That is Judge John Roberts being questioned by Wisconsin Democratic Senator Russ Feingold from the hearings yesterday. If confirmed, Judge Roberts would be the youngest Chief Justice of the United States in over 200 years, setting the agenda for the court for decades to come. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Tomorrow we'll continue to bring you excerpts of those hearings, but right now we go to Texas. Lawyers for death row prisoner Frances Newton are seeking a last-minute stay of her execution. She's scheduled to die later today. On Tuesday, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee held a news conference to urge Governor Rick Perry to stay the execution. On Monday, one of the state's main newspapers, the Austin American-Statesman, came out in support of a new trial for Newton. The paper's editors wrote, quote, "The public cannot be certain of her guilt, but she's going to die for the crime anyway." Newton was denied a basic requirement for a fair trial, a competent lawyer, the paper said. Frances Newton would be the 13th prisoner executed this year in Texas. She'll be the first African-American woman killed in Texas since Reconstruction. We're joined on the phone by Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee and also longtime death penalty activist Gloria Ruback. Gloria Ruback, you co-founded the website freefrances.org. Why are you calling for the stay of her execution? Frances Newton convicted of killing her husband and two kids.
We're calling for a stay, Amy, because there are so many unanswered questions in her case. We're calling for a stay because she had one of the worst lawyers that Harris County has appointed. He sent 16 people to death row, including Shaka Sankofa. Frances is one of four that are still alive. And we're calling for a stay because just this summer, the district attorney admitted on camera that there were more than one gun recovered from this crime, and they have denied this for 18 years. So given the lack of representation, the prosecutorial misconduct, you can't execute people when there's these doubts. And also the Houston Police Crime Lab, which has been discredited, processed evidence in her case.
I'd like to go to a clip of Frances Newton, and we're going to do that in a minute. Frances Newton, again on death row, scheduled to die later today. Let's hear what the prisoner herself has to say.
It's difficult being away from family anyway. I've always kind of been, with all of my brothers and sisters, I've always kind of been insulated, you know, and always had family around me. So it's been kind of hard not having that. And then under the cloud of guilt that I am, losing my husband and my children, that's been difficult, you know. But I just take it one day at a time. You know, I cope with the support that I have, the love of my family and my friends that I have, the love that I have for my husband and my children, and just knowing my own innocence, that helps a lot, you know. I cope knowing that I have people fighting for me, that believing in me and believing that the right thing will be done.
Frances Newton herself, behind bars, scheduled to die later today. We're also joined by Congressmember Sheila Jackson Lee. We thank you for stepping out of this Department of Homeland Security meeting on Katrina to take our call. You held a news conference yesterday. Why?
You know, as I listen to Frances, we cannot think of her as anything but a sister, a mother who lost her children, a wife. And the catastrophe of Katrina equals the catastrophe of injustice that would occur if Frances goes to her death today. This is a last-ditch effort in association with Professor Dow, the Innocence Project, who is, as we speak, has sent a petition to the United States Supreme Court. Today, I will spend my time working with Congressman John Conyers and Congressman Bobby Scott, who I know are interested in this injustice, to try to reach the governor of the state of Texas, Governor Perry, to reach the Solicitor General, who will petition to the United States Supreme Court. I'm asking the Solicitor General to join in Professor Dow's petition for a stay of execution, and I'm asking the governor to recognize, as the president of the American Bar Association has recognized, that justice has not been served. There is the discovery of multiple weapons. There is a complete violation of the Sixth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment, the right to trial by jury of your peers with information and the right to effective counsel and due process. Francis Newton received none of that. It is clear that if you have counsel that did not investigate or ask one question of one witness, pose no investigation, and pose no defense, you did not have an effective trial under the Sixth Amendment or due process. Why, when we are sharing our hearts and minds with the victims of Katrina, when the state of Texas has, in essence, opened its doors, the governor at this point, and particularly at the Board of Pardon and Parole, would refuse to allow a simple opportunity for a 30-day stay of execution? For I cannot understand it. I cannot accept it. I cannot stand idly by. And I would ask the listeners, I know you feel frustrated. Send emails to members of Congress. Send emails to the governor of the state of Texas. Send emails to the Solicitor General of the United States. We must have some relief. So, Amy, that is the basis upon which I'm operating. I wish this would be, or could have been, if you will, a day-by-day, if you will, petitioning. The point is that even with protesting and marching and press conferences, a simple act can answer the question, a simple fair act, not one that says, today we release Frances Newton, today we set her free. It is simply to say that what the court system, what the case law, what the Constitution demands is for the justice system not to send Frances Newton to her death on a lie, but to allow the new evidence to be presented to a jury of her peers.
And what exactly...
Why can America accept that? I don't understand.
Congressmember Jackson Lee, what is the lie? What is the alternative scenario she was convicted of?
In essence, it is the fact that the weapon that was presented at the time of the presentation of a case is the only weapon, or that there is not a confusion in as much as it is said multiple weapons have now been found. The other one is the motive, which is to suggest that she would have received an insurance benefit and she orchestrated it. We have come to understand that the insurance was sold to her, she did not ask for it, and it might not have gone to her anyhow. Those are the kinds of facts that need to come out, but those are the facts. Motive, a monetary motive. To kill your children and your husband, a monetary motive, because we all know that her children were under the age of majority. In that instance, those dollars would have come to the guardian parent. That would have been her. Why then kill the children? And so you don't have the absolute facts of why a mother would have killed both the spouse and the children based upon insurance proceeds. Those are the lines that have consistently plagued this case. The other thing that I would say, why would the board, which I've worked with extensively, just be a tracking device for a single point of view? As far as I'm concerned, it appears, and I will be calling them today, and I don't know how welcoming I will be received, why they could not reconsider their decision to simply allow this extension. Now, many are saying she had an 120-day extension. There is no extension too long to ensure that the person who is ultimately executed, if you believe in that, is not the person who is guilty of the crime. In this instance, there's too much evidence to suggest that Frances Newton is not. It is time now to give her justice and to give her peace of mind and to give this day.
Congressmember Jackson Lee, I want to thank you for being with us. And now, thanks for joining us, as well as longtime death penalty activist Gloria Ruback. Again, Frances Newton scheduled to die today. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Abdul Kadus, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Jeremy Scahill, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami. Again tonight, tune into our website, 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. for the debate. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.